class today is recorded for a database for the programming linguistics, then a database of academic discourse. This is completely independent from the course, and it should in no way inhibit your participation. Just ignore it, basically. What I want to do today with you is use Roth's novel, The Ghostwriter, to discuss two issues that have to do with collective memory after the Holocaust. The first question has to do with the centrality of the Holocaust for Jewish collective memory and Jewish collective identity. And the second question, which we'll examine in the second hour, asks what are the implications of remembering the Holocaust through a symbol like Anne Frank? And I want to start with the essay that I recommended you read, that I included in the course pack, and which you can refer to after the class if your interest has been piqued. The essay from the book The Imaginary Jew, in which he examines the development of his own Jewish identity. It's an essay that I find particularly resonates with my own experience, and I find it really thoughtful and thought-provoking. I must say that I share myself his own development from an unexamined pride of being descending from, if you want, from a family that was affected by the Holocaust, to a more reflexive stance and a more self-conscious stance on the place of the Holocaust in my own identity. And that's one of the reasons why I told you that it was with mixed feelings that I had revealed to you where I come from. But Alain Finkielkraut, who's a French philosopher, writes about this identity. And I just want to quote to you from page 7 in the essay. He's talking about this new Jewish identity that's a privileged identity, as a victim. And he says, "I inherited a suffering to which I had not been subjected. For without having to endure oppression, the identity of the victim was mine. I could savor an exceptional destiny while remaining completely at ease. Without exposure to real danger, I had heroic stature. To be Jewish was enough to escape the anonymity of an identity indistinguishable from others and the dullness of an uneventful life." And I think his the observation is accurate. I think it's not unusual for Jews who were affected more or less directly, or even not at all directly, for taking on this identity of coming after the Holocaust, and somehow this is a privileged identity of a victim. And this imaginary Jew, then, for Finkielkraut, is the offspring of survivors who confers himself this undeserved moral superiority. And his criticism also targets the fact that those who do take on this undeserved identity do so without knowing much of Jewish history or Judaism, and this this romantic identity is a sort of ideal ideal identity as a sufferer, but it's a pose more than a reality. And let me quote another passage that's telling on page 11. He talks about this status that is conferred to him simply by mentioning the fact that he had that he has personal connections to the Holocaust. He says, "I too would recount family stories of the final solution, and my interlocutor, seized by a mixture of stupefaction, shame, and respect, would see in me something other than myself, the faces of those tortured to death." So this is the concept of the imaginary Jew that Finkielkraut discusses, and it raises the question of how central the Holocaust should be for today's Jews and for defining Jewish identity and for Jewish collective memory. The Holocaust tends to be nowadays a central tenet of Jewish identity, especially for American Jews and for Western European Jews. And I want to focus on the American Jewish experience because this is what Roth focuses on, and it's been much discussed. The fact that the Holocaust has often become the centerpiece of the American Jewish experience. Many American Jews go on pilgrimages to Auschwitz, for example. And while the Holocaust has remained fairly tangential to the experience of the general population, while it's only a marginal event for the rest of the population, for American Jews, it tends to be used as a confirmation of Jewish uniqueness. And I think it's particularly acute in this society because of the emphasis placed on multiculturalism. And with multiculturalism, ethnic groups tend to be conferred a special status through suffering. It tends to be the case. I just wanted to give you an example. When I was a graduate student in Madison, Wisconsin, the public schools organized a multicultural fest, and each ethnic group in the schools had their own booth, and pizza was served in the Italian booth, or you can just imagine. And then the Jewish booth was centered around the Holocaust, and it's problematic to represent Jewish identity through an event that is primarily an event of destruction and of suffering. It's not a positive event. It's not. It's not the rich culture that came before the Holocaust and that even continues today. And this use of the Holocaust as a central extent of today's Jewishness has been criticized. I'm not making it up. It's been criticized by Jewish historians, by Jewish cultural critics, because it seemed to be detrimental to furthering the knowledge of Jewish culture, of Jewish history. The writer Philip Lope, whose article I had included at the beginning of the course back, expresses his discomfort with what he calls this extermination pride. And he says that the Holocaust becomes another opportunity for Jewish chauvinism. Others have criticized this phenomenon that the Holocaust replaces as a text, almost replaces the Bible. It becomes the central text for Judaism. And even Spiegelman, in an interview, said, although I find myself probably connected to my Jewishness primarily through the Holocaust, I'm concerned about the idea that someday Christians will walk around with crucifixes and Jews will walk around with little gas chambers around their necks. Scathing critique. But it's satirical, but it rings true to a certain extent. A religious scholar, Jacob Neusner, has written a book about how American Judaism is now centered around two central myths that are related, the theme of destruction and the theme of rebirth. And these two themes are embodied in the Holocaust and then in the creation of the state of Israel. And he argues that Jews have now substituted Auschwitz for Mount Sinai, that the pivotal historical event of Jewish experience is no longer the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, but it is the destruction of European Jewry in Auschwitz. And he actually backs this up. This is not just a theory. He cites a 1988 survey that revealed that five times as many American Jews believed that the Holocaust in Israel were more important to them as Jews than the Exodus and the receiving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. So he talks about this Judaism of destruction and redemption as a new Jewish civil religion. And he talks of it critically, of course. So it's deplored by religious scholars, it's deplored by Jewish historians, and I give you, again, as recommended, an article by the Jewish historian Paula Hyman, who criticizes this focus on the Holocaust to the exclusion of other aspects of Jewish history. And she talks of this focus as the lachrymose theory of Jewish history. Lachrymose meaning it's the basis for crying, for lamentation. And she would rather emphasize the positive sides of Jewish culture and Jewish history. She would want to retain a more affirmative image of a tradition that values life and that does not wallow in death. Um, this attitude has also been criticized for political reasons, because some people argue that today's Jews use the Holocaust as a political weapon, that, and this is what I refer to as the instrumentalization of the Holocaust, that it is used to garner sympathy for Jewish causes, either within Jewish communities for fundraising purposes or on the international scene securing support for example, for Israel or other Jewish political causes. This focus on the Holocaust and the centrality of the Holocaust has not been seen as negative by all people. Some scholars have seen it as only one stage in the learning process about Judaism, about Jewish history and Jewish culture. And some argue that people who come to learn more about Jewish culture through the Holocaust will eventually learn and discover more about the other aspects of Jewish history and culture. So it's like a gateway into more knowledge. So there's not a consensus on this question, but I gave this just as an introduction to our discussion of Roth's novel, because Roth is struggling with this question of what is the place of the Holocaust for the identity of an American Jewish writer. His protagonist. Roth was born an American Jew. He was born in Newark in 1933. And you probably know that he's most famous for his novel Portnoy's Complaint, that was published in 1969. It was a controversial novel, and at the time he encountered critical reactions of the type that Nathan Zuckerman in the novel is encountering. He was accused of portraying his Jewish characters in a negative light and of contributing to fueling anti-Semitism. Throughout his writing career, he's been coming back to the theme of the Holocaust, and he refutes the accusation that he's been exploiting the Holocaust. He says, for most reflective American Jews, the Holocaust is simply there, hidden, submerged, emerging, disappearing, and forgotten. Don't make use of it, it makes use of you. And this is probably what he's trying to examine through the adventure of his character, of his alter ego, Nathan Zuckerman. So the novel takes place in 1956, which is a year after the dramatization of The Diary of Anne Frank was produced on Broadway. And the protagonist, Nathan Zuckerman, is spending the night at the house of fearless woman that he imagines is Anne Frank, who survived the camps, and that leads to self exploration. The reason why he's projecting this fantasy of Anne Frank onto this woman is because he was accused by a friend of his father, Judge Walker, of writing, of contributing to anti-Semitism through his short stories. And Judge Walker urges him to go see the play, The Diary of Anne Frank. And Nathan fantasizes bringing this woman home as his bride. So Roth struggles with this tendency of today's Jews to use the Holocaust as a defining moment in the history, in the identity. And this conflict is embodied in the conflict between Judge Walker and Nathan. How do these two characters relate to the Holocaust? And what is Roth trying to suggest with this conflict between Judge Walker, who accuses Nathan of basically being a Nazi, and Nathan who's simply writing short stories about his family and eccentric characters in his family. What is Roth suggesting?
It seems like the Holocaust was mostly really only thought of within the Jewish community, and it wasn't really something that was discussed outside of the Jewish community. It was more internalized, and it was more of a something that Jews felt that they had to prevent from happening by conforming to what any kind of expectations they thought that there should be for them. But I think that since then, I think it's left this real kind of parochial kind of
But you're right. I think you're right that it's changed somewhat. Although I do think that the reason that Roth is coming to this is reviving this. This issue, because it's not completely something of the past. I think it's still the Holocaust is still used to censor people, to give it's used for providing oneself. Self-righteousness for giving oneself moral superiority.
Ex- ex-
except it doesn't seem like the instrumentalization is necessarily for some kind of like outside pity or sympathy. It's more an internal form of kind of censorship.
Mm-hmm. It's internal, but the judge is also concerned about the image that this writer is projecting of the Jews outside of the Jewish community. So. Involved in Nazi propaganda.
In your son, what about the judge's humility? Where's his modesty? He only met what happened to the Jews in Europe, not in New York. We are not the wretched of Belsen.
Belsen is a concentration camp, and this is the camp where Anne Frank died.
We are not the wretched of Belsen. We could be in their place, we would be. To me, then violence is nothing new to the Jews, and you know that. Ma, you want to see physical violence done to the Jews in Europe? Go to the office of the plastic surgeon where the girls have their noses fixed. That's where the Jewish blood flows in X County. That's where the blow is delivered with a mallet to their bones and to their pride.
Okay. I think we can stop here. What is he arguing here? What is Nathan saying here? Separate himself. it's still part of his identity, and he's trying to figure out what to do with that tension, with that friction. And in this scene, it comes across as a very aggressive criticism of American Jewry. The fact that he's yelling, I think, seems to suggest that he's ill at ease with the questions that the judge has been asking him. That it does raise questions. And Roth leaves, he's a writer, and he leaves the tension unresolved. He doesn't. He's playing these two characters against each other to raise the question, but he doesn't resolve the question. He leaves it open. But he does use the situation, I think, to criticize those who end up using the Holocaust to give meaning to their Jewishness, or to give themselves to make themselves right. So the Holocaust becomes a symbol that's appropriated to justify any opinion or action. And Nathan appropriates the Holocaust, at least in fantasy, by imagining that he's going to marry Anne Frank, and this is the most radical way to proclaim his loyalty to Jewishness by marrying the most famous Holocaust victim. And he's trying to counter the judge's authority by bringing up this icon, almost as a trophy in this battle. So this brings us to the second question that I wanted to examine with you. What are the implications of remembering the Holocaust through a symbol like Anne Frank? And I should preface our discussion with a disclaimer. I recognize that the Diary of Anne Frank is a very important and useful tool to introduce the Holocaust, especially to teenagers, to younger readers. Probably some of you have read it in school. Have any of you? Yeah, some people are nodding. So, it's a beautifully written diary. It's an amazing document. And through the diary, Anne Frank is an amazing individual. But learning about the Holocaust through Anne Frank is also problematic, because her story tends to obliterate the wider story, and this is what I'd like to examine with you. Let me give you the historical background to the publication of the book. Her her diary was first published in 1947 in Holland, in Dutch. And it was translated first into French and German in 1950. But it's only in 1952, when the diary was published in the United States, that that it reached a wide audience. And then in 1955, it was dramatized and produced on Broadway, dramatized by Frances Goodrich. And one person associated with the Holocaust, it would be Anne Frank. And so Roth, I would argue, is exposing this iconization of Anne Frank, the turning of Anne Frank into a fetish, into an icon in popular culture, in collective memory. A passage in which Nathan is arguing, and he says, everybody is from the poor. This is a story that's too often remembered at the expense of others. But I'd like to examine with you what kind of memory the story of Anne Frank fosters, whether it's an accurate memory of the Holocaust, or whether it's distorted. Roth, I think, seems to suggest that it's this turning of Anne Frank into a symbol is limiting and is bothersome. She's become a saint. And it's interesting that when he wrote The Ghost Rider, he at first was approaching Anne Frank through this lens, through this this lens of sanctifying this character. He said, when I began, I was somehow revering the material. It was the tone appropriate to hagiography. Instead of Anne Frank gaining new meaning within the context of my story, I was trying to draw from the ready store of stuck emotions that everybody's supposed to have about her, cling to the cliché while anxiously waiting for something authentic to take hold. In retrospect, my difficulties look somewhat bizarre, because just what Superman was fighting against, I was in fact succumbing to, the officially authorized and most consoling legend. I'm going to show you, we'll take a break, and then I'll show you the end of the movie, of the 1959 movie, made after the play. And then I'd like to discuss with you why you think this story was so popular and what's problematic about it. So let's take a break now. questions and answer the question. It's really open-ended. So,
like, how can
you can refer to them. It's really an open question. It's something that, you know, that I want you to reflect about it. So if there are things that are relevant in what we've discussed that you can bring into your yeah, it's very open.
Right. Are they going to do tomorrow?
No, I'll have them do again on Friday.
Yeah.
understand all the questions. An excerpt from the diary with an excerpt from the play, and part of the dialogue here will be in the scene that I'm going to show you from the movie. So if you want to take it out, I have some extra ones if people need it. Otherwise, I can just go over each of this. We'll discuss this after I show you the discussion. Any else?
Dear vegetable man is on his way to a concentration camp. He was picked up today for hiding two Jews in his house.
There's not much. It was Mr. Hawk, our greengrocer, that arrested him. The other news is the Gestapo have found our typewriter that was stolen.
No.
Uh-huh. They'll trace it back and back till it gets to us. You watch, you.
Everyone is low. Even father can't raise their spirits. I have often been downcast myself, but never in despair. I can shake off everything if I write. And that's the great question. Will I ever be able to write well? I want to so much. I want to go on living even after my death.
There it goes again. Mr. Brown, do you hear?
Yes, I hear.
This is the third time. Third time in quick succession. It's a signal. I tell you, it's me trying to get us. For some reason, she can't come to us, and she's trying to warn us of something.
Please, Mr. Wilson, please.
You're wasting your breath.
Something has happened, Mr. Frank. It's been 3 days. Now that Reap hasn't been to see us. And today, not a man has come to work. There hasn't been a sound in the building.
Perhaps it's Sunday.
You may have lost track of the days.
Who was the diary there? What day is it?
I don't lose track of the days. I know exactly what day it is. It's Friday, the 4th of August. It's Friday, and not a man at work. I tell you, Mr. Crowder is dead. That's the only explanation. He's dead, and it closed down the building, and that's what Meep's trying to tell you.
He would never pay it for us, Mr. Booth.
Please, I beg of you, Mr. Frank, answer the phone.
No, just picking up the list. You don't have to speak. Just listen and see if it's me.
For God's sake, answer the telephone!
I've told you no. Nothing that might let anyone know that we are in this building.
Mr. Crouchard.
There's no need to tell us what side you're on.
If we wait here quietly and patiently, I believe that that is good for us.
Dearness of you, Peter.
forgiveness of the people we know. Mr. Crowley, the vegetable man. All of them risking their lives for us every day. When I think of these good things, I'm not afraid anymore. I find myself in God and my peace.
It's fine. I begin to think I get mad. Look at us. Hiding out here for 2 years. I'm not able to move, caught like waiting for them to come and get us.
Thank you.
past to me as we have lived in fear. Now we can live in hope.
Same thing practice, you know.
on page 144. I'll just read it to you.
Page 144.
But that was the point. That was what gave her diary the power to make the nightmare real. To expect a great, callous, and indifferent world to care about the child of a pious, bearded father living in the despair of the rabbis and the rituals, that was pure folly. To the ordinary person with no great gift for tolerating even the smallest of differences, the plight of that family wouldn't mean a thing. To ordinary people, it would probably seem that they had invited disaster by stubbornly repudiating everything modern and European, not to say Christian. But the family of Otto Frank, that would be another matter. And by the way, the Franks were originally German Jews, and they had moved to Holland before the war, and then hid in Amsterdam. But they were virtually not observant. They did exchange presents at Hanukkah and things like that, but they were not religious at all. How could even the most obtuse of the ordinary ignore what had been done to the Jews just for being Jews? How could even the most benighted of the Gentiles fail to get the idea when they read in Adapterhurst the name of the place where they're hiding? How's it called in English? The annex. They were hiding in a part that was camouflaged by a moving library thing. How could even the most benighted of the Gentiles fail to get the idea when they read that once a year the Franks sang a harmless Hanukkah song, said some Hebrew words, lighted some candles, exchanged some presents, a ceremony lasting about 10 minutes, and that was all it took to make them the enemy. It did not even take that much. It took nothing. That was the horror, and that was the truth, and that was the power of her book. So the fact that she is like everybody else, that she's not an other, she's not different, makes her an easier target to identify with, an easier victim to identify with than if she had been one of the Polish Jews, for example. You don't see the horror, right? You don't see it, yes, Susan?
Yeah, I think that's why that makes her so popular too. That's why she's what everyone knows about. She's not writing about the horror of the concentration camp. She's not telling how what she's talking about hiding. And that, granted, I'm not saying that was easy, but that's completely different than, you know, people who write about the actual camps. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sandra?
Yeah, I think the Holocaust kid is like removed, but it's present in the fear.
Like it's probably more likely to appeal to all the readers than those that have been read.
when she's a child, she's a teenager. So, like, her diary goes through, like, her interest in Peter and, like, her family, and it lets you into her life, and it's not just the concentration camp or just the Holocaust. I think that's really the whole perspective.
Yeah, just like an example of like the way it's constructed in the play is just like an inspirational story. Like people like. I mean, maybe because it makes them feel better about themselves or even their own kind of pretty good situation compared to hers. It's just like an example of someone somehow, you know, raising their spirit and dealing with something so horrible, so positive, you know. But at the same time, it's probably not representative, and it also is accessible. And like you were saying, it's like a way that people can approach the Holocaust without having to approach some of the like specific and actual graphic. Like it's like a PG-rated version almost, kind of compared to like you know a more R-rated version. Like it describes the camps and things like that. You know,
she's not just lifting her spirit, she's kind of redeeming her. In the book, they try to send Nathan Zuckerman off to see the play, you know, like cleanse his soul of all these, you know, bad ideas. And then in the last scene there, she's like ministering to Peter up in the attic with like the light streaming in on her from the window.
Yeah,
it's
just there's a lot of really good things have been said, but the idea that her story is obliterating the horror, but it's also redeeming our idea of the human spirit. I want to read you a sentence from the preface to the American edition of the diary. And the preface was written by Eleanor Roosevelt, the president's wife at the time. And she wrote that Frank's book made her, I quote, shockingly aware of war's greatest evil, the degradation of the human spirit, but at the same time, Anne's diary makes poignantly clear the ultimate shining nobility of that spirit. And it's again this idea that her story only gives us a limited awareness of the history of the Holocaust and makes avoiding the center of the tragedy possible. And Roth even questions whether reading Anne Frank's diary really makes its readers better person, better people, better individuals, whether the readers of the diary are improved morally. Right. I wanted to look at a passage in the novel. It's on page 145, 146. And this is written from the point of view of this fantasized Anne Frank who would have survived in Nathan's imagination. This was the lesson that on the journey home she came to believe she had the power to teach. The lesson about the Holocaust. Were it after hers known to be the work of a living writer, it will never be more than it was, a young teenager's diary of her trying years in hiding during the German occupation of Holland. Something boys and girls could read in bed at night along with the adventures of the Swiss family Robinson. But dead, she had something more to offer than amusement for ages 10, 15. Dead, she had written without meaning to or trying to a book with the force of a masterpiece to make people finally see. And when people had finally seen, when they had learned what she had the power to teach them, what then? Would suffering come to mean something new to them? Could she actually make them humane creatures for any longer than the few hours it would take to read her diary through? In her room at the in the plot of this novel. After hiding in her dress and the three copies of it after hers, she thought more calmly about her readers-to-be than she had while pretending to be one of them on the stirring bus ride through the lightning storm. She was not, after all, the 15-year-old who could, while hiding from a Holocaust, tell Kitty's her imaginary friend in the diary that she writes to. I still believe that people are really good at art. Her youthful ideals had suffered no less than she had in the windowless freight car from Westerbork and in the barracks at Auschwitz and on the Belsen Heath. She had not come to hate the human race for what it was. What could it be but what it was? But she did not feel singing its praises. What would happen when people had finally seen the only realistic answer was nothing? To believe anything else was only to yield to longings which even she, the great longer, had a right to question by now. So Roth is really questioning whether the diary is teaching people to be more moral human beings. And one of the reasons why he's questioning that is precisely because she's a character that is so easy to empathize with. If she were an other, then the reader of the diary would be forced to make a moral leap and to identify with someone that is not easy to identify with. But because she's so sympathetic, the reader doesn't really have to make much of a moral effort to identify with her story. So this is what Roth is implying here. I also wanted to comment on this idea that her story is used to redeem the idea of the shining nobility of the human spirit, as Eleanor Roosevelt says. And especially the play and the film, by ending on this uplifting statement, turn her story into a cathartic story. They give the audience the illusion of having been purged of the horrible story, and of having escaped the horror. It's a feel-good play. In the end, it's a play, it's a movie that makes you cry a little bit and then go home and forget about it. And this is, again, expressed in The Ghost Rider on page 123. And someone read that. It wasn't a play. And again, this is this imagined entry of this.
It wasn't a play. I could have watched that easily enough if I had been alone. It was the people watching with me. Carloads of women kept pulling up to the theater. Women wearing fur coats with expensive shoes and handbags. I thought, this isn't for me. The billboards, the photographs, the marquee. I could take all that, but it was the women who frightened me, and their families, and their children, and their homes. Go to a movie, I told myself. Go instead to a museum. But I showed my ticket, I went in with them, and of course it happened. It had to happen. It's what happens there. The woman cried. Everyone around me was in tears. Then at the end, in the row behind me, a woman screamed, "Oh no, that's why I came running home."
Okay. Another funny passage in the novel in which Roth is mocking the effect of this play. The women can't afford to wallow in luxury because because they go to this place to purge themselves, and then they come out of this, and life goes on. They exorcise them. Maybe they're guilty for living in luxury or for having not had to experience the harm. And as I said, the play and the film emphasize Anne Frank's positive side and even her moralizing side. In the diary, she's much more irreverent, and there's a documentary that was made a few years ago called Anne Frank Remembered, which I recommend to you if you're interested in Anne Frank's story, in which many of her contemporaries were interviewed about her, and they revealed that she was actually a much more mischievous little girl than she's made to be in the film, The Diary of Anne Frank, where she's turned into sentimental saint. I'm just going to read you some reviews of the play that came out in 55. The play was incredibly successful and won prizes. And it was reviewed as a lovely, tender drama. One reviewer wrote about the happy effect of animating everyone into doing a little more than he's capable of doing. Someone wrote about it as not a war play or even a sad play. So this is what her story became. The diary itself is incredibly powerful, because she develops into a very fine human being in just the course of 2 years. It's amazing to think that she was only 14 and she was writing what she was writing. But the play just completely softens her personality and the whole reality around her, and turns the whole thing into a melodrama. She was actually a much more ambivalent character, and the influence of the play and of the movie have been long-lasting and have not only obliterated the horror of the Holocaust itself, but the true story of Anne Frank, and even 30 years after the play in 1985, Congress passed a joint resolution to designate June 12, 1985, as Anne Frank Day. And they explain why they chose to do that. And I'm quoting here from the resolution. They wanted the people of the nation to reflect on the message of Anne Frank, that in the face of evil, it is possible to retain a belief in humanity. And they just lifted this from the play and from the movie. I don't think they even bothered to check the diary. So it's interesting to see how memory, this collective memory, is shaped, and it's important to remain critical of that process. Yeah.
Philip Roth kind of puts it in religious tones too, when he has the idea of Anne Frank dying and sort of being resurrected. You know, there's this kind of like Christian idea in the part when he was talking about how, why it is that she has to die, you know, why she has to be dead. It's because, you know, what would, you know, something like Christianity be if, you know, Jesus hadn't died, you know?
Right. She can only be a saint if she died. If she had survived, she would be, her experience of hiding for 2 years would be of no consequence, even though it would have been the same experience and also worthy of knowing. But, right. And wrath then by resurrecting her is also refusing to preserve this sentimentalized image, and he turns this imaginary end into a cynical survival. And the ending of Roth's novel is, a direct response to the ending of the film. He's mocking this kitschy Hollywoodish ending of Anne and Peter kissing passionately when the Nazis come up the stairs. He ends his novel with a scene in which the wife of Lona, of Nathan's mentor, is leaving in the snow and is stumbling through the snow. She's leaving this marriage that's a trap for her. And ironically, her name is Hope. This is, you know, I think, a direct response to the line in the movie, we have lived 2 years in fear, now we will live in hope. I think he's just playing with that and turning it upside down. And basically he's saying, you know, my novel is not a prison. It's made you laugh, but I won't let you off the hook. I'm not going to write a cathartic novel. I won't let you hope too much.
There's also kind of part when he's in the study there at night, like listening, you know, like a lot of, you know, Anne Frank had to do with, you know, these people listening, you know, waiting to hear people come up the stairs. And so he's listening and he hears these people, you know, getting to bed or, you know, whatever. Like, that's kind of stuff. He uses a lot of the same kind of imagery.
Yes, yeah. He's rewriting the diary. But he's rewriting for satirical purposes, not for sentimental purposes. So, I wanted to raise a lot of questions regarding the issue of Jewish collective memory and also American collective memory of the Holocaust. Tomorrow we'll talk about the difficult question of German collective memory. And I'll show you an excerpt of a documentary and then we'll discuss the reading that I sent you. We hand in the papers. And again, I'm changing the due date for the last set of papers to Friday, so that we have some time to complete them. We have time to do it tomorrow. Friday, there are only two papers, and tomorrow I'll give you the question for the final. Yeah, the final week. Because you'll have a week to do it, so there's no reason to do it. The papers, both Shoshana and I found the papers much improved, so overall.
Okay.